Welcome to Presenting Alfred Hitchcock Presents, presented by the Ann Arbor District Library. I'm Al Sheridsma, and if you look up Malus Domestic, which is the title of tonight's episode, you will find malusdomestic.org, which tells us that Malus Domestic is an annual fan convention that takes place each year in Maryland, celebrating the traditional mystery, books best typified by the works of Agatha Christie. The genre is loosely defined as mysteries which contain no explicit sex or excessive gore or violence. But it will also tell you that that convention was established in 1989. Washington Independent Review of Books.com gives us a definition of cozy, traditional, Malus Domestic mysteries, saying they usually take place in a confined setting, such as a village or house in the country. They are frequently identified with the British Agatha Christie, although the form was established much earlier with the work of Americans Anna Katharine Green and Mary Roberts Rinehart. But this definition also says that the phrase Malus Domestic is defined by the mystery convention of the same name. Cozy-mystery.com tells us about the Malus Domestic anthology series, but the first one of those came out in 1992. There is a novel by Molly Hardwick entitled Malus Domestic, but it precedes the fan conventions by only 1 year, published in 1988. So is there anything further back that uses the title? Well, yes, there's a novel by Sarah Woods, published in 1962, but even that's too recent for our 1957 broadcast, or for Philip MacDonald's short story, which first appeared in 1946. So is the short story the first time the phrase is used? Well, when in doubt with a title, it always pays to check out Shakespeare. And in this case, we'll find it in Macbeth, Act 3, Scene 2, the speaker being Macbeth himself.
We have scorched the snake, not killed it. She'll close and be herself, whilst our poor Malice lives in danger of her former tooth. But let the frame of things disjoint both the worlds suffer ere we will eat our meal in fear and sleep in the affliction of these terrible dreams that shake us nightly. Better be with the dead, whom we, to gain our peace, have sent to peace, than on the torture of the mind to lie in restless ecstasy. Duncan is in his grave. After life's fitful fever, he sleeps well. Treason has done his worst. Nor steel, nor poison, Malus Domestic, foreign levy, nothing can touch him further.
Come on, gentle my lord. Sleek o'er your rugged looks.
The website enrightenglish20.weebly.com defines Malus Domestic in this context as hatred in his own land. In our case, we get more precise than that. The malice will be within a home. But whose malice is it? Here's Hitch, who is pacing back and forth, his hands gripping his lapels, his thumbs pointed upward, acting the role of an attorney.
Good evening. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the first case on today's docket is entitled Malus Domestic. I hasten to add, however, that Malus Domestic is not about the servant problem, nor is it a puff for imported wines. It is concerned with some mysterious doings in a family of three, Carl Borden, his wife Annette, and their charming dog Cassandra. To give you a clearer picture of exactly what happened, we now transport you to the scene of the crime where we shall reenact it.
But before we do that, His Honor wishes to charge the jury. So here's Malus Domestic. First broadcast on February 10th, 1957. Starring Ralph Meeker and Phyllis Thaxter. Teleplay by Victor Wolfson, based on a story by Philip MacDonald, and directed by John Meredith Lucas. Almost all of those names are familiar to us, This is Ralph Meeker's second of four appearances after the very first episode, Revenge. It was my very first episode, too, more or less, and I hadn't yet established the routine that I usually follow now. So here's what I said about Ralph Meeker back in that early podcast.
A nice little piece of trivia is that Bezirides was also the scriptwriter for the film Kiss Me Deadly, which came out in that same year, 1955, and which also starred Ralph Meeker playing Mike Hammer in a classic film noir with one of the craziest endings you'll ever see. So if you haven't seen Kiss Me Deadly, you should check it out. Ralph Meeker is not necessarily well remembered today, though he was a very accomplished actor in the 50s and 60s mainly. He was born Ralph Rathgeber, and before he played Mike Hammer in Kiss Me Deadly, he took over from Marlon Brando on Broadway to play Stanley Kowalski in A Streetcar Named Desire. He's in a couple of other Hitchcock episodes, as well as other classic noir anthology TV like The Outer Limits. And he died in 1988 at the age of 67.
So let's add to that a little bit. Wikipedia tells us that he first rose to prominence for his roles in the Broadway productions of Mr. Roberts and Picnic. He later appeared on Broadway in Eugene Ionesco's Rhinoceros and Arthur Miller's After the Fall. Wikipedia says he went on to play a series of roles that used his husky and macho screen presence, including a lead role in Stanley Kubrick's Paths of Glory, as a troubled mechanic opposite Carol Baker in Something Wild, as a World War II captain in The Dirty Dozen, and in the gangster film The St. Valentine's Day Massacre. He also appeared in a lot of television episodes, starring in the series Not for Hire, which ran one season from 1959 to 1960. He was also, as I mentioned, in The Outer Limits, the episode entitled Tourist Attraction, and the 1964 suspense series in an episode entitled I, Lloyd Benson, or is it I, Lloyd Denson? IMDb lists both, but I suspect that whoever wrote I, Lloyd Benson had Michael Dukakis's 1988 Running Mate on the brain. Ralph was also in the made-for-TV movie The Night Stalker, which served as the springboard for the Kolchak The Night Stalker TV series. But in 1980, he suffered a stroke, which forced him to retire. He was living in the motion picture and television Country House and Hospital when he died there in 1988. Now, I didn't give it a thorough listen, but I suspect that back in that first episode, I didn't give Ralph a clip of his own. So let's give him one now, as Mike Hammer from his most famous role in Kiss Me Deadly.
Hello, Mr. Hammer. You handle yourself pretty well.
I figure it's a good thing to speak a lot of languages. Any country you go to, you can take care of yourself.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can speak my language, okay?
Like putting torpedoes in gifts?
I'll admit that was a little crude. We keep underestimating you. Frankly, I don't know what's in your mind. What do you want, Mr. Hammer?
Well, yesterday I was looking for a thread. Today I'm looking for a piece of string.
And tomorrow, who knows, huh, Mr. Hammer? You don't even know what you're looking for.
Tell me.
Trouble. That's what you're looking for, Mr. Hammer, trouble. You know how lucky you are? That drop off the cliff didn't kill you, the torpedo should have. Or sugar. What'd you do to him anyway? You scared Charlie half to death. Look, Mike, I like you. I like the way you handle yourself. You seem like a reasonable man. Why don't we make a deal? What's it worth to you to turn your considerable talents back to the gutter you crawled out of?
Name a price.
And you'll try to emphasize, huh? Oh, you're cute. You ought to know better than anyone what it's worth.
I set my fee according to the case, and the longer I look at this one, the higher it gets.
Oh, it does, huh?
Maybe you'd like to make an exploratory offer just to get the ball rolling.
Okay, Mr. Hammer. It's been nice talking to you, Mr. Hammer. Wrap around again sometime.
When I do, maybe I'll have a better notion of what my fee is.
It's too late to set a fee, Mr. Hammer. Suddenly it's too late.
We'll see him next in Total Loss, episode 17 of season 4. So what about the rest of those familiar names? Well, this is Phyllis Thaxter's third of six Alfred Hitchcock Presents and three Alfred Hitchcock Hour appearances after Never Again and Fog Closing In. Her next is The Deadly, episode 11 of season 3. This is Victor Wolfson's fourth teleplay of six after The Perfect Murder, The Orderly World of Mr. Appleby, and Toby. His next is Specialty of the House, episode 12 of season 5. And we're saying goodbye to director John Meredith Lucas in his third of three episodes after Jonathan and Crackpot. And you can see his work next in Ben Casey, The Invaders, The Fugitive, Star Trek, Night Gallery, Planet of the Apes, and The $6 Million Man, among others. Here, he begins us in a party, attended by extras, giving us four times as many characters as we had in the entire episode last time. The camera starts high, up by the chandelier, as we see two people come through a door, each of them holding a drink in each hand. The camera lowers and backpedals as they make their way through the crowd, and then finally settles as they meet up with two other people. The two that we have followed are Carl and Annette Borden, played by Ralph Meeker and Phyllis Thaxter. And as they approach the other couple, we learn the name of the other woman right away.
Oh, there you are, Lorna. Been looking all over for you.
Thank you.
We've got to have a farewell drink together.
From the opening to Annette's line, we've got one continuous camera shot. But once we've dispensed with the extras and settled on these four people, the camera switches, getting down to their level as if we're the fifth person in their little circle of friends.
You've no idea how much we're going to miss you.
Town won't be the same without you.
Well, I'll miss you too, all of you. It's been wonderful living here. I've made so many friends.
We're counting on absence making the heart grow fonder.
And now, for the most part, we move into close-ups of each speaker, beginning with Lorna.
That's the trouble with the career. The firm commands, you can only obey. But I love it.
We mustn't lose touch with one another.
Oh, for heaven's sakes, Annette, she's not going to Timbuktu.
That's Carl speaking, and once he says that line, he gives Lorna a look. A look that, to me, gives the entire game away in the first minute.
I'll certainly be coming to visit you if you'll have me. I want to see how Cassandra is getting along. I'm so glad you're taking her.
Cassandra, what a name for a dog.
In Greek mythology, Cassandra is the daughter of King Priam and Queen Hecuba of Troy. She has the power of prophecy, but she is cursed in that her prophecies are either ignored or not believed. When Troy falls, she's taken as a concubine by Agamemnon. Agamemnon's wife, Clytemnestra, has schemed with her lover, Aegisthus, to murder Agamemnon when he comes home. Cassandra prophesizes the betrayal and the murder, but is not believed, and she is killed along with Agamemnon. Now, is any of this going to be applicable to the dog in our story? We'll see.
It's a shame you have to give her away.
Well, I can't have a dog that big in an apartment.
Well, you couldn't have given us anything that Carl would like better. He adores all dogs, with or without pedigrees. You'll have to tell me exactly what she likes to eat.
Oh, she's not at all finicky. It's quantity with her, not quality.
If you cook for her the way you cook for me, she'll put on 10 pounds in a week.
Carl's spoiled. What more could a man want? He's got a wife that's an artist in the studio and an artist in the kitchen.
It's his art I'm worried about. Brady becomes so entranced with the dog, he'll never finish his book. Come September, and we'll have your publishers howling across the country.
I hope you won't find Cassandra too much trouble. She's quite housebroken.
I'm sure we won't.
Just be firm. Treat her as you do Carl.
No dog could stand for that. Let's have a dance.
And having provided us with a little exposition, the couples pair off to dance, and we leave the party, dissolving to the front door of the Borden house as Carl and Annette enter. It's a long shot, so we can see a couple of doors and the stairs. Annette is still talking about Lorna, but Carl dismisses the small talk and starts calling for Cassandra. He ends up going into another one of the rooms. Annette starts to go upstairs, but then she hears Cassandra whining, and she goes to yet another room, her artist's studio. The camera moves inside the room, and it's dark as she enters, but she turns on the light to reveal Cassandra, who is a Great Dane, cowering underneath one of her shelves. And we see that Annette's art is pottery.
Oh, for heaven's sake. A big thing like you huddling there in the corner.
The camera looks down on Cassandra, almost over Annette's shoulder, so that Annette seems to tower over the dog. But Cassandra then starts to leave, and we get a quick cut to the room where Carl entered. He is sitting in an armchair, and he is already cuddling with Cassandra, much sooner than it should have taken her to get from one room to another. Now, Carl and Cassandra are in the foreground of the shot, with the camera at about their level, as Annette enters from behind and approaches, again, towering over them. So, whether we're familiar with the Greek myth or not, here's what the show seems to be trying to tell us. Carl, as Agamemnon, is being warned by Cassandra of a danger from Annette looming large as a threat in her role as Clytemnestra. All we need now is Annette's lover.
Well, she certainly seems to like you.
All the girls do. Go on over and shake hands with the lady of the house. Come on, Cassandra.
Come on, Cassandra.
Come on. Go on, idiot girl. Go on.
Cassandra does no such thing, and we are left with a close-up shot of Annette from a low angle. To the tune of Carl's laughter, she looks rebuffed and slighted. We move to sometime in the future and into Annette's studio, where she is at her potter's wheel, creating a vase with a long, very small neck. She's proud of what she's done, and she calls Carl in from his office, where he is working on his book, to see what he thinks. He admires it.
That's beautiful, dear. What color do you plan to make the glaze?
Oh, some sort of an antique green, a celadon to carry out the Chinese effect.
I really think that's one of the best things you've done.
But he gets a little surly when Annette implies that he should be working faster on his book.
How's your work coming?
Fine.
You'll be finished by the 15th.
I think so.
Carl, I try very hard. Not only because of the deadline, but this is a perfect time for a story like this.
I'm writing as fast as I can.
Annette is already shorter than Carl, and in this exchange she sits so that he towers above her. She tries to send him on his way.
Well, we both better get back to our work.
But he tries to make up, leaning in to kiss her.
Oh, you know what all work and no play makes.
Only to have her shy away.
What's the matter, darling?
I just wanted your opinion on my vase.
Something's wrong. What is it?
It's nothing. I've just been working very hard, and you know how I am when I'm in one of my creative moods.
Just tell me what I've done.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Now, don't tell me it's nothing. It's been going on for weeks. Ever since you came back from that trip, you've been different.
Carl, that's what I've been thinking about you. You know, I think we're two very stupid people, imagining all sorts of things that don't exist.
Okay, so it's been several weeks since Annette took a trip. This is the first we've heard of it. What sort of trip? Did she travel alone? Where did she go? Well, none of it matters, really. It's all a big MacGuffin. We never find out anything about this trip. It's only set up there to make us think that perhaps Annette has had some sort of tryst and is now becoming more distant from Carl.
You mean there's nothing really wrong?
Of course not, you idiot.
Prove it.
He leans in again to kiss her, and this time she responds, only to have their kiss interrupted by the warnings of Cassandra. Cassandra is outside on the other side of a door, apparently barking to be let in, and we get a nice brief shot of her in the background, down low, but right in between Carl and Annette, who are in the foreground. If Cassandra's reason for barking was to get in between Carl and Annette, then she has done it, both figuratively and literally. All that's left is for Carl to make a lame joke to end the intimacy.
Well, it just goes to show you, two women can't live happily in the same house.
Annette smiles at this and hugs him, but that seems to be it. We quickly move away from the scene. Now the camera shows us a dinner table, It looks like dessert has been finished, and it's time to clean up. There is a guest there, and as he hands his plate to Annette, the camera raises up to see her. This guest is the same man who was with Lorna at the party. She gave us his last name.
Well, if you can stand spending your last night doing a last generation foxtrot, I'd be a very happy partner.
Mr. Harrison, I shall be delighted.
And now we learn his first name.
Oh, there was a delicious dinner, Annette. I still contend you're the best cook in town.
You're always so flattering, Perry. You've no idea what it does to my morale.
How about a liqueur?
Oh, thanks.
Your usual green mint over ice?
Yes, please.
How about you, darling?
You don't have to ask me.
So what does that mean, precisely? That he knows what her favorite liqueur is? That she doesn't want one? That she always serves herself? Again, it's a MacGuffin, leading nowhere except perhaps to implant some sort of suspicion. Because it's shortly after that that Carl exhibits some real discomfort, even as we were getting more exposition, learning that Perry is a banker and Annette apparently has investments of her own.
How's everything at the bank, Perry? I suppose my investments are losing money.
You know I look after them as if they were my very own.
What's the matter?
A little indigestion, I guess. I'm all right now.
Hadn't you better call Dr. Wingate?
No, it's nothing. I'm all right now. I'll get some ice.
Carl moves into the kitchen, and the camera moves behind Perry so that we can see Carl in the background as the conversation between Perry and Annette continues.
Annette, I'm playing golf on Tuesday. How about having lunch with me at the club?
I'd love to.
Oh, what are you working on now?
Oh, a vase. It's based after an old Chinese design.
I think it's one of the best things she's ever done.
Oh? I'd like to buy it when it's finished.
I'd like you to have it, Perry.
That invitation to lunch, followed by a quick change of subject, seems rather suspicious. Could it be that Perry is Aegisthus to Annette's Clytemnestra? But it gets forgotten quickly because, in the background, Carl doubles over in pain. With that, the camera switches to inside the kitchen, and the dramatic music rises. As Carl manages to call the doctor before collapsing on the floor. And so we dissolve from Carl on the floor, his head pointing stage left, to Carl on the couch, his head pointing stage right, as the doctor examines him. We also go from Carl telling the doctor,
I don't know what it is,
to Annette having the very next line.
What is it?
The doctor, whom Carl knows personally and calls by his first name, Ralph, but who also lives in a time when you can call him up and he'll rush over for a house call, doesn't know. He has a couple of guesses.
Well, it could be a virus or something he ate.
He tells Carl and Annette that he'll run some tests next week. Now, Perry is still there, and he and Ralph have a short conversation because, of course, they know each other, too.
There's nothing serious, is it, Ralph?
Oh, I don't think so. Of course, I'll know better next week. Just see that he gets some rest, Annette.
Yes, I will.
Annette, how about lunch? 1 o'clock, all right?
Yes, 1 o'clock's fine.
You your lift, Perry?
Oh, no thanks. I have my own car.
Perry is hardly subtle. Even though Ralph is all the way over at the front door, he clearly hears Perry confirming the lunch date with Annette, which is something that plays very nicely into the case against her. Now, if both of these actors sound familiar, it's because we've met them both before. Perry is played by Ralph Clanton, and this is his third of 7 episodes after The Gentleman from America and The Legacy. His next is Flight to the East, episode 25 of season 3. And Ralph is played by Vinton Hayworth, and this is his second of 4 episodes after Mink. His next is Martha Mason Movie Star, episode 34 of season 2. After the men leave, Annette returns to the other room to find Carl sitting up and playing with Cassandra. And it's here where perhaps it starts to feel like Cassandra is less the prophetess and more of a surrogate for her previous owner, Lorna. Particularly when Carl says to Cassandra,
what do you say, baby? You want to go to bed now? Huh?
Well, we can't stick around for that. So we dissolve to the country club, which it turns out is where we were for the party at the beginning of the episode, as Ralph enters and makes his way through the crowd to find Annette and Perry having lunch. It's pretty clear that he's scoping them out and that this is not an accident. And when he finds them, the camera gives us a shot of him standing between the two of them seated, breaking up the couple as surely as Cassandra did to Carl and Annette in the earlier scene. Perry is none too happy about any of this. First, Ralph sits between them, saying he'll have a cup of coffee. Then he brings up Lorna and chats with Annette about her. Then he decides he doesn't really want the coffee and he needs to go. And Annette also decides it's time to go, with Ralph giving her a lift, leaving Perry behind, still looking put out. So in his large 1950s convertible, Ralph drives Annette right up to her front door, where they hear Cassandra barking. Assuming something must be wrong, they both rush inside and find Ralph collapsed on the floor in Annette's artist studio. The vase that Carl called the best she's ever done is lying smashed next to him, which is a nice little projection of what Carl will do to Annette later. It's time for the commercial, and when we return, Carl is sitting up and Ralph is examining him. He apologizes to Annette for breaking her vase.
Oh, honey, I'm sorry about that vase. I was just putting it back on the shelf when I blacked out.
Ralph tells Carl that he should spend a couple days in bed and eat no solid foods. And then once he leaves, Cassandra comes through the door, and Carl perks right up. We get a close-up of Annette feeling left out again, and that segues to a close-up of Cassandra, with Carl's arm reaching down to pat her on the head. If, as Carl says,
well, it just goes to show you, two women can't live happily in the same house.
Then Annette is losing. It's the next day, and Annette settles into her role as the scold to tell Carl he shouldn't be up and about. Carl tells her he's hungry, and she offers to get him some orange juice. And then the phone rings, and it's Ralph.
Hello? Oh, hello, Ralph.
How do you feel?
Fine. Awfully hungry, though.
Haven't eaten yet?
No.
Good. Don't. Want to run another test while the stomach is empty.
Oh, not again.
I'll be right over.
So Ralph is also running tests on his house calls, which explains how he's already run some before.
After all those tests you gave me and those gadgets you used, I ought to be able to eat anything.
So Ralph shows up, and he tells Annette that he would like to speak to Carl alone.
Good morning, Ralph.
Morning.
Well, what are you looking so happy about?
Carl, I want you to be serious for a moment. You were mighty sick yesterday.
You're telling me.
You're lucky not to be dead. Where did you have lunch yesterday? What did you eat?
I ate at home. Annette fixed me a bowl of onion soup before she went out to lunch with Perry.
So you ate the soup, and soon after, you were seized with violent pains, retching, collapsed unconscious, right?
Yeah.
The report I got from the laboratory this morning shows that you swallowed at least a grain and a half of arsenic.
A grain and a half? That's quite a dose, isn't it?
Could have been fatal.
So what tests could Ralph possibly do at Carl's home that would give him a lab report that Carl had ingested arsenic? Well, a PDF from the New York State Department of Health says, the most reliable way to test for recent arsenic exposure is through a urine test. So no wonder we didn't see that on screen.
Well, how could I have gotten any arsenic? Fresh vegetables or something? They spray them, don't they?
They don't spray with arsenic anymore. Then there was that other attack last week, remember?
Yeah.
You ate at home then, too.
What are you hinting at?
I'm not hinting, I'm telling you. The chances against it being accidental are 1 in 1,000. Someone is feeding you arsenic.
If I didn't know you so well, I'd break your neck. I know what you're driving at, but you're wrong. If I've been poisoned, there's obviously some kind of a weird accident.
Arsenic is easy to get, Carl. Ant paste, weed killer.
All right, I've heard enough.
I'm sorry, but I had to tell you.
I can't stop you from thinking your rotten thoughts, but I can't stop you from talking, and I will. If you so much as breathe a word of this to anyone, I'll kill you. And don't forget that, because I mean it.
Well, that seems a little extreme. But maybe the surest way to get someone to talk about arsenic poisoning is to make sure they know that you're not going to do anything about it.
Goodbye, Ralph.
Goodbye, Carl. I've told you. Now it's up to you.
And it is indeed up to Carl. As soon as Ralph leaves, Annette joins Carl and asks him what Ralph said, and Carl lies to her.
Oh, he just used a lot of medical jargon. I don't think he knows any more than I do. I've got a nervous stomach, that's all, but now I feel fine.
We're supposed to think that he's protecting Annette, or that he doesn't want Annette to know that they're on to her, but it's actually just the opposite. He's making sure Annette never hears anything about arsenic poisoning at all, because then she might wonder who is doing the poisoning. Right on the spur of the moment, they decide to go on a fishing trip to Big Leaf Lake, leaving the next morning.
Oh, but what about your vase? Don't you want to finish that first?
Come here. I want to show you something.
And she leads him into a nice camera shot of the vase on the right in the foreground as they watch it from behind. It's the same one that Carl broke, but Annette has remade it and put a glaze on it.
Well?
What a beautiful color. Well, I never saw a green like that.
We're going to have to take his word on that.
That's the secret of my success, mixing colors.
But how do you get that translucent quality?
You won't go telling my professional secrets, will you?
No, I swear.
It's a copper glaze. Remember when we were in the south of France last year?
Yeah.
Well, I went over to Valerie to see the ceramics. I learned this trick from one of the artists I met there. I sprinkle a little of something they call the Mauge green into the glaze before I fire it. And
this is actually the second time we've heard about the green glaze, although I didn't bother to play the clip beforehand. Here it is.
That's beautiful, dear. What color do you plan to make the glaze?
Oh, some sort of an antique green, a celadon to carry out the Chinese effect.
So our teleplay writer, Victor Wolfson, is not springing anything new on us. He's playing fair with us until we get to this moment. Annette goes to answer the phone, and it's Perry, while Carl goes over to look at her glazes, and he picks up a tin that has a very simple label on it. It says Limoges Green, and then below that, Arsenic Poison. We even get a close-up of just that part of the label, just in case we missed it. And still holding the tin, Carl looks over his shoulder as if he's discovered the source of his poisoning. The problem here is, if I haven't made this clear enough already, that the poisoner is Carl. But when Carl picks up the tin and looks over his shoulder, there's no one else in the room. So he isn't fooling anyone except the only people watching, us, the TV audience. Although I suppose you could argue that he's just rechecking the tin that he's using and looking over his shoulder to make sure Annette doesn't come in. It does bring up the question that if this is the source of Carl's arsenic, should Annette notice that there is less in the tin when she glazes the vase? Well, she doesn't, and she's off in the kitchen talking to Perry. When she's finished, Carl makes sure that he's back over by the vase as she brings in a glass of orange juice for him.
Well, I guess there's no harm in the juice now. You must be starved.
Annette, do you love me?
Why, yes, of course I do. Why did you suddenly ask a thing like that?
Here's to you, darling.
Carl's question is another bit of a cheat, because Annette doesn't know why he's asking it, and the only people who do know are we, the viewing audience. Or so we think. It looks like Carl has asked that question to then decide to drink the orange juice whether it's poisoned or not. And the background music is in cahoots with him because it gives us the feeling that something momentous is happening here as he drinks that juice. But it's not. Instead, we dissolve to Carl packing his manuscript into a suitcase. There are something like six other suitcases around him, plus a large thermos, two tackle boxes, and a fishing net. These people know how to pack. Annette comes in, carrying two cups of coffee.
Cup for the road. Bags all packed?
All packed. I want no complaints out of you.
Oh, I forgot the sugar.
Now you're going to behave yourself at that kennel while we're gone.
So, with Cassandra perhaps acting like the ignored prophetess again, Annette goes back into the kitchen to get the sugar. We follow her so that we don't see what Carl is doing, But whatever it is that Carl is doing, he must have done it fast, and he must have had it well hidden, and he must have known that Annette was going to bring them coffee.
Oh, did you get my fishing equipment?
You bet. That's the most important part of the luggage. Remember the first time we went to Lake Tahoe? Hmm. That log cabin by the lake?
Yeah. With the two bunk beds and one blanket for the two of us. And I got cold.
Let's not talk about the past. Long live the future.
Another line that doesn't mean what we think it means. And then Carl gives her what amounts to a farewell kiss, and then starts bringing the luggage out to the car, with Cassandra following him. Carl has a private chat with her.
And don't look at me with those big, limpid eyes. What goes on behind those big, sensitive eyes of yours, hmm? Oh, if you could only talk. A lot of privacy a couple would get then, wouldn't they? I guess God knew what he was doing when he made man's best friend dumb. Bless you for being dumb, baby.
Now, this could mean all sorts of things, but I think it mainly means that Cassandra, as a witness, is a mute witness. Carl then calls back to Annette for the benefit of the neighbors, I suppose.
Oh, Annette, I don't see the liquor here. I remember seeing a packet, but... Oh, I know, it's in the study. Come in.
So Carl goes back into the house, and he finds Annette stretched out on the floor, the two coffee cups and saucers, an overturned table, and the sugar bowl on the ground beside her. And she is most definitely dead. Now, medicalnewstoday.com says that a person who has swallowed arsenic may show signs and symptoms within 30 minutes. So this seems a little bit quick. But after all, if we don't allow a little artistic license here, then Carl's scheme will never work at all. And so after Carl checks on her, we dissolve to later, with Carl sitting at a table, petting Cassandra, talking to Perry. As the camera pulls back to reveal Perry, Ralph also enters the frame, eliminating Perry from the conversation and from any of the shots for the rest of the episode.
Well, if it had to happen, I'm glad it happened this way. You wouldn't let me take care of you, but the fates did. Obviously, she was overconfident. Some little thing distracted her attention, and she made the mistake and drank the wrong cup of coffee. She poisoned herself instead of you.
But she seemed so happy with me. We were going on a trip together.
I don't want you to worry about anything here. There won't be any unpleasant scandal or publicity, nothing like that. You see, I knew. And in spite of what you said to me yesterday, I told Chief Nichols. Well, he and I talked to the coroner, and they've agreed to play it down as much as possible. I think you ought to get away from here as soon as you can. Away from this house. Make a complete break.
The camera moves in on Carl's disturbed, distressed face, showing just his eyes, nose, and mouth, and fades to black. But immediately fades up again with a similar shot of Carl, only now he looks calculating and maniacal. The camera pulls back to show him driving a car.
I took a big chance, baby, but it worked.
And who is he talking to? Well, we cut to the person in the passenger seat, and it's Lorna, with Cassandra, her surrogate, sitting in between them. We then switch to a shot of all three of them.
The first time I wasn't too sick because I just took a small dose of arsenic. But that second time, that second time you almost lost me altogether. I'll tell you, I was sick as a dog.
And so we finish with a close-up of Cassandra, her ears raising up, as if reacting to Carl's statement. And the music gets bouncy and cheerful, as if this pretty miserable situation turned out to be sort of a laugh after all. Now, there are two people involved in this episode that we have not encountered before, one of whom is in the car at the very end. Not Cassandra, who doesn't get a credit, but Lily Cardell, who plays Lorna. She was born in Sweden in a small town called Norrköping. Now, IMDb says that her father was an orchestra leader, but there is a webpage created by the daughter of Lily's cousin, which is probably more reliable. And she says he ran a barber shop. Sanna, the daughter of the cousin, says that when Lily, who was born Ingalill, was 16, she showed up at Nalen, a night jazz club in Stockholm, and was spotted by a talent scout for Topsy Lindblom, who was the owner of Nalen and responsible for a beauty contest. Lily came in second place, and having fallen out with her father, stayed with Topsy and asked him to adopt her. He refused to do that, but he did lend her money, which she later paid back, helped her get a job at an office, and also part-time work as a model. Not long after, she moved to the United States and ended up with a film contract with Universal and some modeling contracts. She also became very close to James Dean. Now, Sanna's webpage on Lily contains some newspaper and magazine clips, and one from the October 1955 issue of Modern Screen has a story entitled "The Secret Love That Haunts Jimmy Dean." Her name is Lily Cardell. Not so long ago, when no one else cared, Lily and Jimmy fell in love. And the writer, Imogen Collins, describes Lily as a 19-year-old beauty with soft blonde hair and big blue eyes. She stands 5'4½" tall, weighs 108 pounds, and has a figure that offers the best of Marilyn Monroe and Anita Ekberg combined. Lily moved to New York for some television work, and James Dean was making the few films for which he is famous. But they remained close and saw each other when they could. But then on September 30th, 1955, Dean was killed in an auto accident. Lily later called it the saddest day of her life. In 1958, Lily married Peter Paxton, an insurance broker, but that marriage only lasted a year. This is a clipping from an unidentified newspaper. "Walking husband shed by actress." Swedish actress Lily Cardell, 23, won a divorce yesterday on testimony her husband, Peter V. Paxton, 34, walked off into the desert, returning only because he was afraid of snakes. "He had to have everything his way, otherwise he would have a tantrum," she told Superior Judge George A. Dockweiler. "He was nasty and rude to me in front of friends. At a dinner party in Palm Springs last May, he started belittling me, and when I asked him why he had married me, he said it was the greatest mistake of his life. When we returned to our bungalow, he picked up his shaving kit and walked into the desert," she recalled. An out-of-court property settlement was effected. The actress was restored her maiden name, Cardell, and she waived alimony. About a year later, Lily became engaged to Troy Donahue. This is from an article from an unidentified periodical entitled, "It's Great to Be in Love Again." Being in love is one thing, getting married is another. Troy admits his girls have wanted to get married too many times for comfort. There were more dates, many of them dark-haired beauties, but when Troy got serious again, it was with blonde Lily Cardell, who used to date the late Jimmy Dean. Lily even has an engagement ring from Troy, but no one in Hollywood is going to hold his breath till this wedding takes place. Troy considers himself basically conservative, and he likes his girls the same way. "I'm tired of seeing slacks on girls," he says frankly. "I like a girl who's real feminine. I like a girl in pumps and stockings and a skirt and sweater with her hair in a fresh, easy-looking style." On dates as well as in private, Troy likes to go to the beach, go surfing or sailing, go to movies. "I don't go to many nightclubs," he says. "They depress me." In addition to liking the same type dates, he and Lily can help each other study scripts, and she's teaching him to play golf. "I like girls an awful lot," he grins. "They rarely gripe me, but I don't like to see a girl drink. The influence of alcohol takes away from her beauty. And another thing, I don't care for fluffy pinks on anyone." It's quite a guy Lily has herself engaged to. Now the question is whether or not she can get him to add a plain band to her third finger, left hand. Troy has never thought much of the idea of going steady. "Of course, it depends on the individual," he says. "A person should first of all be honest with himself. To go steady when you don't want to, well, that causes complications." Could be the same thing applies to being engaged. So after hearing all of that, it's not completely surprising to learn that the marriage never took place. This is from Sanna's website. One evening, she went unannounced to Troy's home and found him with another woman. Troy was like another person. Not only that, he hit her more than once, and she had to seek medical care. In a moment, my whole life was different. It felt like a sick nightmare, she told the press. Over and over, I told myself this couldn't happen to me. He just told me he loves me. Shortly after this, Lily accused him of domestic violence, and years after the incident, she told the press that falling in love with Troy Donahue was my biggest mistake in my life, and I will regret it as long as I live. In the mid-1960s, Lily left acting and became, according to Santa, a real New Yorker living on 55th Street. Also, according to Santa, she worked as a home decorator and then as a fashion designer, though IMDb says she became a professional mediator for the state of New York. And Lily Cardell died in 1987, 1 month shy of her birthday. IMDb says she was born in 1936, which would make her 50. But Santa says she was born in 1931, making her 55. Now, she was in a couple of movies, but most of her work was in television, and mostly in the 1950s, in such shows as Annie Oakley, M-Squad, Rawhide, 77 Sunset Strip, Wagon Train, Sea Hunt, Richard Diamond, Dragnet, and an episode of Steve Canyon, in which she played Lieutenant Lyden. Now, she may have been a lieutenant, but she was also a woman in the Air Force in the 1950s. Or at least in a 1950s TV series. So she gets treated like this.
Colonel Canyon, I would like to meet Lieutenant Lyden.
How do you do, Lieutenant?
How do you do?
Well, 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 Colonel. Please make yourself comfortable.
Thank you.
Let me offer you something, Colonel Canyon. Want some aid or some coffee? I've just some made.
Coffee'd be fine, thank you.
Well, 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 well. You know who sometimes sat there? In that exact chair in which you are doing it?
No, who, Commander?
General MacArthur. General MacArthur. Definite fact.
You don't say.
Oh, yes. He made for a time his headquarters here, you know.
That's right. We reinvaded the Philippines from here, didn't we? 1944.
Have you been before to New Guinea, Colonel?
Never have.
It's very large here. Very big. Did you know that? This is the second biggest island in the world. Definite fact. Cream. Sugar?
Black's fine.
You know what is the largest island in the world?
Well, let me see. It's between...
Greenland. Definitely, Greenland.
Lieutenant Lyden...
Thank you.
Lieutenant Lyden, you are stealing my best decent conversation.
Oh, I beg your pardon, Commander. I was attempting only to...
You're attempting only to steal my best decent conversation? Lieutenant Lyden is an excellent officer, but she's also a blabberpuss. Mm. Or to put it another way... She is a blabberpuss, but also an excellent officer.
I'd say, Commander, that this coffee alone makes Lieutenant Lyden essential to your base.
Uh-huh. You have convinced me. I'll let her stay. So, you are spreading goodwill among us also? I understand that is the nature of your missions these days. You are en route to the Philippines and then home, huh?
That's correct.
How long do you expect to remain here with us, Colonel?
Just till tomorrow night. I'd like to look your place over if you can spare anyone to give me the 50-cent tour.
Well, I suppose there's actually no reason why not. Lieutenant, if your duties will permit, would you?
They'll permit.
This is Lily Cardell's only appearance in Alfred Hitchcock Presents. The other person we have not encountered before is Philip MacDonald, who wrote the short story. He was born in London, the son of author Ronald MacDonald, not to be confused with the clown of the same name, and of actress Constance Robertson. And he was the grandson of George MacDonald, who, according to Wikipedia, was a Scottish author, poet, and Christian congregational minister, who became a pioneering figure in the field of modern fantasy literature and the mentor of fellow writer Lewis Carroll. Philip served in World War I with the British cavalry in Mesopotamia, and he later trained horses for the army, also raising Great Danes, which may help to explain Cassandra's breed in the episode, although in the story, the dog is a giant schnauzer as big as a Great Dane. Now, Philip married writer F. Ruth Howard, and they moved to Hollywood in 1931. But previously, in 1924, he had his first detective novel published, The Rasp, which introduced his character Colonel Anthony Gethryn, who appeared in a dozen more of his novels, one of which was The List of Adrian Messenger, which was turned into a 1963 film starring George C. Scott. So it's not surprising that a number of his screenplays concerned detective series characters, such as Charlie Chan in London, Charlie Chan in Paris, The Mysterious Mr. Moto, Mr. Moto's Last Warning, and Mr. Moto Takes a Vacation. But he also wrote other types of works, including the 1927 novel The Patrol, which was about a squad of British soldiers in the Mesopotamian desert during World War I, which was filmed in 1934 by John Ford as The Lost Patrol. And he dabbled in science fiction, writing the novelization of the 1956 film Forbidden Planet. His short story, Private Keep Out, appeared in the very first issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. And if you haven't heard of him, perhaps you've heard of one of his various pseudonyms: Oliver Fleming, Anthony Lawless, Martin Porlock, W.J. Stewart, and Warren Stewart. Some of his short stories were the basis for episodes of Lights Out, Suspense, and Thriller, and he wrote teleplays for such series as Riverboat and Perry Mason. His story, Love Lies Bleeding, appears in Hitchcock's anthology Stories They Wouldn't Let Me Do on TV, and his story Our Feathered Friends appears in Alfred Hitchcock Presents Stories for Late at Night. And he worked on the adaptation of Daphne du Maurier's novel Rebecca, which was then passed along to Robert Sherwood and Joan Harrison to write the screenplay. Philip MacDonald died in 1980 at the age of 79, and this is his only Alfred Hitchcock Presents credit. Now, the story was first published in the October 1946 issue of Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where it took second place in the Ellery Queen Short Story Contest. Here is the introduction for that story in that magazine. Philip MacDonald's first detective novel was called The Rasp. It was published in 1924 and introduced the always hot and bothered, nerves at fever pitch, Colonel Anthony Gethryn, who is constantly storming about and wrestling frantically with powerful deductive problems. Indeed, a colonel in the fullest English sense. Anthony Gethryn stuck. He is now one of the most famous of fictional sleuths, and The Rasp is universally conceded to be a modern classic of the genre. Philip MacDonald's latest detective novel is Warrant for X, which first appeared in 1938 and is also considered a modern classic. No less a homicidal handspringer than the late Alexander Wolcott hailed Warrant for X as a masterpiece. He rated it the best detective story I have ever read in any language, which is high praise even from the highly volatile Wolcott. In the 14 years between these two classics, Mr. MacDonald wrote 36 novels, several plays, and quite a few short stories. Surely enough work to satisfy any one man and to constitute an undeniably busy career. And yet that's not the half of it. In 1931, Mr. MacDonald was called to Hollywood, and since that time he has made wine in the Hollywood vineyards. His screen credits are staggeringly impressive. They include The Lost Patrol for RKO, Mr. X for MGM, Rebecca for Selznick, and Blind Alley for Columbia. Mr. MacDonald came to America 15 years ago, planning to stay only 2 or 3 months. He is still here, and we hope that he not only continues to make California his home, but that he takes the final plunge of American detectivization by joining Mystery Writers of America, Incorporated. The invitation to do so is hereby cordially extended. For Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine's first annual short story contest, Philip MacDonald submitted a story titled Malice Domestic and was awarded one of the second prizes. The story ranked extremely high with the judges and was in the running for first prize until the very last ballot. It is not, unfortunately, a Colonel Gethryn tale. To the best of your editor's knowledge, the doughty colonel has not yet made his debut in a short story. For that blessed event, we look forward eagerly to Mr. MacDonald's entry in the current EQMM contest, hoping that Mr. MacDonald will permit his high blood-pressured colonel to grapple mightily with the short tech form. Malus Domestic is a crime story of the before-the-fact species, a type of story that has grown enormously popular in recent years and is now at the height of its vogue. It tells the events leading up to the tragedy, with emphasis on the psychological interplay between the murderer and the intended victim. The plot unfolds slowly but inexorably, each new incident adding to the suspense, each new development tightening the grip of circumstances, each new exposure of the murderer's plan another coffin nail in the victim's inescapable fate. When successfully written, this kind of story achieves almost unbearable tension. It has been said of Philip McDonald that he is not an innovator. That is true. The psychological study of murder told from the inside has been the forte of other writers, notably Francis Iles, and before him, Mrs. Belloc Lowndes. It has also been said of Philip McDonald that he is a polisher and improver of established techniques. This is equally true, as Malus Domestic proves. There are only three important characters in Malus Domestic: the husband, Carl Borden, his wife, Annette, and the family friend, Dr. Tom Wingate. They hold the threads of the story. But if you watch closely, remembering that the master's hand is quicker than the human eye and the human mind quicker than the master's hand, you will become increasingly aware of a fourth character, a character in the background, an invisible force. That character might be called Death, or more accurately, Death's understudy. Now, the story doesn't begin with a party, and Lorna is nowhere in sight. Instead, it begins with Carl heading into his neighborhood bar for a quick drink before joining Annette, who has gone shopping and has her arms full of packages. Our narrator tells us that they were regarded by everyone who did not know them well as an ideal couple, but their few intimates of late had been vaguely unsure of this. Now, Carl goes into a shop where a girl gives him a giant paper sack stuffed over full with a gallimaufry of purchases. He picked it up, and the bottom tore open, and a shower of the miscellany sprayed to the floor. Carl swore beneath his breath, and the girl said, "Oh, drat," and whipped around to help him. He put the things he had saved on the counter, then, stooping, retrieved a thick pamphlet called The Rose Grower's Handbook and a carton labeled Killweed in white lettering above a red skull and crossbones design. Now, when he first hooks up with Annette, the narrator tells us that she smiled at him. But later, when Carl sees Dr. Wingate walking along, he calls out, "Hi, Tom," and smiled his first smile of the morning. So, already several hints as to what might be going on. Now, here, the dog is not named Cassandra, but GB, because something about its bearded face and sardonic eye had always made Carl think of Shaw. Now, it seems to me that you don't name a dog in your story after George Bernard Shaw without reason. It could be that Carl is sculpting Annette's death in the same way that Henry Higgins sculpts Eliza Doolittle in Shaw's Pygmalion, which was later converted into the musical My Fair Lady. Or it could be a commentary on the way Shaw's Arms and the Man combines war and love. Or maybe it's directing us to Man and Superman, specifically the segment known as Don Juan in Hell, which, as the Los Angeles Times puts it, deals with the conflicting impulses of the human soul and the eternal attraction-repulsion between the sexes. Or it could just be that Shaw's bearded face and sardonic eye look a little bit satanic. One thing is clear: that the notion of the dog imparting Cassandran prophecies was inserted by our teleplay writer, Victor Wolfson. Another difference between GB and Cassandra is that GB has always been owned by Carl, or rather by Carl and Annette. Although Annette notes, "It is peculiar. He does not like me lately." A little later, as Annette is cleaning up after dinner, we are told she was bright, talkative, smiling, and although the dog lay directly in the way of her path to the kitchen and would not move for her, she made no complaint but walked around him. Now, another change is in Perry, who is not one of Annette's intimates, but is a neighbor, who is often referred to as Old Perry. And he's the one that first finds Carl after Carl collapses outside walking GB. And it's Perry who calls Carl's doctor, Thomas Wingate, who then drives Carl home. And we learn that Annette does not like Thomas. She comes right out and says it. And did I mention that Annette is French in the story? Don't ask me why, unless it's to present her as an alien other, and that she calls Carl Carlo, so that she says, Carlo, mon pauvre, I am sorry I was not nice to your doctor, chérie, but, eh bien, you know that I do not like him. And I think we can assume that the feeling is mutual, so that Thomas is already suspicious of Annette. And after Carl's second bout, we learn that Thomas has taken the wastebasket into which Carl has vomited along with him so that he can get a lab report on its contents. For the most part, though, there are more similarities than differences between story and episode. There is the moment where Carl suggests that Annette has changed after a trip she has taken. There is the moment where Carl asks Annette if she loves him before drinking something that we think may be poisoned. And there is the moment when Carl comes back into the house and finds Annette dead. But then there's the ending, with our one and only reference to Lorna. It was 3 weeks before Carl permitted himself to smile, and then he was not in El Morro Beach. He was in San Francisco, and Lorna was waiting for him. When he smiled, he was driving up Market Street, GB erect beside him. "Tell you something, boy," he murmured. "I nearly took too much that second time." The smile became a chuckle. After The Lodger, Hitchcock directed 6 more Silence before coming to what he considered the next true Hitchcock film, Blackmail. The first of those 6 was Downhill, which had nothing to do with skiing, but everything to do with disillusion. Released in the United States as When Boys Leave Home, it, like The Lodger, starred Ivor Novello. And it was based on a play by David Lestrange, which was actually a pseudonym for Ivor himself and Constance Collier, who later appeared as Mrs. Atwater in Hitchcock's Rope. Now, after The Lodger, Hitchcock, as Patrick McGilligan puts it in Alfred Hitchcock, A Life in Darkness and Light, set about trying to divorce himself from Gainsborough Studios. He was preparing to sign with British National, but in the meantime, he also got married to Alma. Here's Patrick McGilligan again. The calendar now said 1927, and the nascent British National was looking less and less like a viable reality. J.D. Williams, the new studio's dynamic managing director, had made his first fortune selling his first national circuit of several hundred theaters to Warner Brothers. Williams signed D.W. Griffith star Dorothy Gish for the first 3 British National pictures, to be directed by Herbert Wilcox. But Williams soon alienated his business partners with his autocratic decision-making and imperial lifestyle. He was fired in December, shortly after returning from a deal-making trip to America, and the much-publicized Gish films were canceled. Wilcox, a founding partner, left to form his own studio. Rumors spread that British National was down for the count, and so, desperate to stall, British National lent Hitchcock back to Gainsborough. When Gainsborough announced a new production called Downhill in early December, there was no director attached, but by the end of the year, Hitchcock had surfaced as a likely candidate. Shooting began as quickly as possible. Working closely with Angus MacPhail, now head of the story department at Gainsborough, Elliot Stannard had crafted a straight-line adaptation. Though the actor was in his 30s, the early scenes required Novello to play a lad in his teens, a trick that worked better on the stage. Hitchcock didn't think much of the whole business. "Terrible," he always muttered about Downhill, pointing out the ham-handed imagery of a scene in which Novello is tossed out of his home by his father and then heads down an escalator into the underground. Before that scene, we get a shot of a sign at the underground that reads, "Underground to anywhere, quickest way, cheapest fare." And while there's a crowd of people outside the underground, when we get to the escalator, it is Ivor Novello going down alone. Of that scene, Patrick McGilligan adds, "Hitchcock would often find more affection for his memories of making a given film than for the finished product. The down sequence had to be photographed after midnight," Hitchcock recalled, "after the last train had gone home. We went to the theater first," the director said, "and in those days we used to go to a first night in white tie and tails and opera hats. So after the theater, I directed this scene in white tie and top hat, the most elegant moment of direction I've ever had." And Peter Aykroyd, in Alfred Hitchcock, A Brief Life, writes, when it came to be known that Hitchcock would be directing Novello at Maida Vale Underground Station after midnight on a Saturday, a large crowd clustered at the entrance. Novello was to be filmed descending an escalator, an effect never before attempted, with the obvious intent of suggesting the downward movement of his life, together with vertigo and general instability. It took 5 takes and almost 4 hours, as the actor, caked in grease paint, made the journey down the wooden escalator. Hitchcock held the camera still for 23 seconds in each take, where other directors might have allowed 5 or 6 seconds. All right, but what is the film about? Well, here's an exchange of Hitchcock's and Truffaut's from the Hitchcock-Truffaut book that gives us a decent plot outline, though Truffaut mistakenly says at the beginning that our main character, Roddy, is accused of theft. Actually, the film begins with a title card that reads, "Here is a tale of two schoolboys who made a pact of loyalty. One of them kept it at a price." One of those schoolboys, Timothy, has an affair with a shop girl and gets her pregnant. But she blames Roddy, and he, honoring the pact of loyalty, accepts the blame. Now here's Truffaut. The school authorities expel him, and his father wants nothing more to do with him. As I remember it, he then has an affair with an actress and becomes a professional dancer in Paris. Then we find him in Marseille, where he thinks of shipping out to the colonies. Instead, he goes back to London, where his parents, who, in the meantime, have learned he was innocent all along, welcome him with open arms. The action is scattered in all kinds of different places, starting out in a British college. It moves on to Paris, and then to Marseille. Hitch says, "The original play was written that way." That's strange. Since it was a play, I would imagine that all the action would be set in the one location in the college. No, it was done as a series of sketches. It was a rather poor play. As it happens, the author was Ivor Novello. As I remember it, the atmosphere of the school was very meticulously recreated. Yes, but the dialogue was pretty dreadful in spots. And just like the transparent ceiling, there was another naive touch that wouldn't do today. That's when the boy is thrown out of the house by his father. To show the beginning of his downhill journey, I put him on an escalator going down. There was a very good scene in the Paris cabaret. Yes, there I experimented a bit. I showed a woman seducing a younger man. She is a lady of a certain age, but quite elegant, and he finds her very attractive until daybreak. Then he opens the window and the sun comes in, lighting up the woman's face. In that moment, she looks dreadful, and through the open window, we show people passing by carrying a coffin. There were also some dream sequences. I had a chance to experiment in those scenes. At one point, I wanted to show that the young man was having hallucinations. He boarded a tiny schooner, and there I had him go down to the forecastle where the crew slept. At the beginning of his nightmare, he was in a dance hall. No dissolve, just straight cutting. He walked over to the side wall and climbed into a bunk. In those days, dreams were always dissolves, and they were always blurred. Though it was difficult, I tried to embody the dream in the reality in solid, unblurred images. For that scene, according to Donald Spoto in The Dark Side of Genius, The Life of Alfred Hitchcock, during the editing, Hitchcock instructed the lab technicians to tint a pale green the scenes of Novello's delirium when his health fails. He remembered from his earlier playgoing the green stage lights for the appearance of ghosts and for the world of fantasy, and he now employed a primitive monochrome instead of the conventional blurring at the edges to suggest a hallucinatory state of mind. So you can see that in spite of Hitchcock's negative view of the film, it does have its interesting moments. Let's backtrack a bit to the moment after Roddy is rejected by his father. The title card says, "The World of Make-Believe," and we get a shot of Roddy looking prosperous. Then the camera pulls back and you realize he's a waiter. And then the camera pulls back and shifts around to show that he's actually on stage in a play. In Hitch, The Life and Times of Alfred Hitchcock, John Russell Taylor calls this scene a sort of Chinese box of illusion within illusion. Roddy falls for the leading actress of the play, Julia Fotheringale, played by Isabel Jeans, who will also appear in Hitchcock's Easy Virtue and The Lady Vanishes. She doesn't really want anything to do with him. She's involved with her leading man until Roddy gets a telegram that tells him that he has inherited £30,000 from his godmother. With that, Julia agrees to marry Roddy until she runs through all of his money, after which he discovers her with the leading man. He tries to kick them out, but she tells him that he has signed the apartment over to her, so she kicks him out. As he leaves the apartment, he takes the elevator, and we get a close-up of his finger pressing the down button. That's when Roddy ends up selling dances at the Moulin Rouge Music Hall for 50 francs a dance. And that's where he meets the woman that he thinks is different from all the rest. There's a title card that says, "You seem different somehow amidst all this artificiality." But she's not. When we get a title card that says, "Searching relentless sunlight," as Wikipedia puts it, the morning light comes through the windows, and Roddy is repelled by the tawdry, decadent scene and the woman's masculine-looking face, including a little bit of a mustache. But Hitchcock, in that conversation with Truffaut, misremembers. It's not Roddy who opens the curtains. It's that daylight has come, and so the Moulin Rouge is closing down, and we have drunken people staggering about and slouched in their chairs at their tables. And there's no scene of people carrying a coffin as Roddy leaves the Moulin Rouge. But he's going further downhill nevertheless, and that's when he arrives at the Marseille docks and has his hallucination. Some sailors get him on the proper ship, and after 5 days of delirium, he finds himself back in London, where a title card tells us that blind instinct led him home. There he finds that his father has been looking for him because he has learned the truth and asks Roddy for his forgiveness, and we have a happy ending. Here's a couple of other little nuggets from John Russell Taylor. He says that Hitchcock shot a scene in which Ivor Novello and Ian Hunter, who played Isabel Jean's leading man, have a knockdown fight which starts quite seriously with them formally dressed. Then they start throwing things, which get bigger and bigger, until they are each wrestling with pedestals almost as large as themselves, which end by knocking them both down. But the studio took a dim view of this farcical turn of events. It was, they said, no way to present a romantic idol, and out the scene had to come. Though there is still a knockdown fight between Ivor Novello and Ian Hunter. John Russell Taylor goes on to say, when the rest of Downhill was completed, they still had a couple of necessary close-up shots left to do of Novello staggering through the East End of London on his return to England. Hitch had already begun work on his next film, Easy Virtue, and was on location on the Riviera. Novello came down very grandly, checked into the Hotel de Paris in Nice for one night, gave a lot of interviews there in his suite, and then, having got that out of the way, vanished to a very humble pension for the rest of his time on location. The shots were done on the flat roof of the pension, with a couple of men holding a painted backdrop of the London docks, while Novello walked on the spot in front of it in the bright Mediterranean sunlight, and the natives looked on incredulously, speculating as to what on earth these crazy Englishmen could be doing. And here's a tidbit from Peter Aykroyd. There was another instance of what might be called the heroic age of filmmaking. At one showing of Downhill in a London cinema, the lights and the screen went up in the middle of the production to reveal Novello himself on the stage, dressed in the part he played, who then proceeded to enact the next 10 minutes of the narrative for the benefit of the no doubt surprised audience. Donald Spoto in The Dark Side of Genius quotes Michael Balkan. We looked to the theater for much of our screen material, and our early films would certainly now be called stagey. We followed trends and did not try to make them. It was doubly a mistake to lean on stage plays because we were making silent films, so the plays were deprived of their very essence, the words. Our policy did not always pay off. So did it pay off in this case? Well, Donald Spoto quotes one reviewer who said, "The story is a distinctly weak one, and only expert handling and imaginative production finally made it interesting." Spoto adds that Biograph, for the benefit of interested exhibitors, remarked that the selling angle is the name of Hitchcock. We can't ignore the fact that women do not fare well in this film. The Encyclopedia of Alfred Hitchcock by Thomas Lech says, "It is by far the director's most misogynistic work, overflowing with images of women as harpies and betrayers who prey on helpless young males like Roddy." And Donald Spoto in Spellbound by Beauty says, "All the female characters in Downhill are reprehensible cheats, liars, or insatiable sensualists." But Peter Aykroyd takes a more general view and says that Downhill is a successful study in deceit, cruelty, and perversion. The interiors are like prison scenes illuminated by shafts of sunlight, and as Novella begins his ineluctable journey downwards, Hitchcock conveys his characteristic sense of the world as perilous and unstable. So, after all that, is it worth seeing? I think so. In spite of its flaws, there is enough Hitchcock technique here to make it interesting and worthwhile. Now, while Hitch did not agree with my view of this film, he was always a great defender of the silent film in general. Here he is with François Truffaut.
Perhaps we'd like to have a few generalities on silent pictures.
Well, silent pictures are the pure motion picture form. There was only one thing missing in the silent pictures, and that was sound coming out of the people's mouths and sounds coming from the streets. But it didn't warrant the big change that sound brought in.
Mais ça ne justifiait pas le grand changement que le son a amené avec.
In other words, you see,
c'est-à-dire
the silent picture
les films muets
was merely looking at them purely from a realistic standpoint.
Les regardant d'un point de vue réalistique,
it was natural sound that was missing.
C'était réellement le son naturel seulement qui leur manquait.
In other words, there was no need to abandon the technique of the pure motion picture
du cinéma pur,
the way it was abandoned
la
when
façon,
sound came in.
De la manière dont ça a été abandonné quand on a amené le son.
C'est ça. Et oui, sûrement dans les dernières années du muet.
Yes, surely in the final years of silent pictures.
Dans l'ensemble, enfin, de la production, peut-être.
On the whole, the production, perhaps.
On était arrivé à
they
certaine perfection.
In reaching a certain amount of perfection.
Tel qu'on peut penser.
Such that one might think.
Que le parlant a détruit cette perfection.
Sound picture destroyed that perfection.
Je veux dire qu'il y a eu de nouveau beaucoup de médiocrité.
I mean to say that again, a lot of mediocrity came in.
Or of course, immediately.
Oui, immediately.
It still sustains to this day.
Et jusqu'à ce jour, c'est vrai.
Because to me, as I've said to you earlier this morning, so many of the films made today are photographs of people talking.
Des photographies de gens qui parlent.
C'est ça. Oui.
Back to Malice Domestic for a moment. This is a nicely constructed episode, subtle and well acted. I like the way the suggestion that Annette is involved with Perry assists in covering Carl's doings, but I also like the hints such as Carl crushing Annette's vase and his over-the-top affection for Cassandra that signify what is really going on. Both the complete-hitchcock.com and an IMDb reviewer declared themselves completely fooled by this episode's twist, which surprises me, because I think Carl's look at Lorna at the party gives the game away right at the beginning. The story doesn't give the game away, but I prefer the episode to the story because the story doesn't tell you about Lorna until the finish. The episode plays fair, which I prefer, even if it allows me to guess the ending. In his comparison of the endings of the story versus the episode, Jack Seabrook puts it well. In his blog at barebooneseasy.blogspot.com, Jack writes, "The biggest change from story to show occurs in the final scene. In the story, Carl is talking to his dog as he drives to meet a woman in San Francisco. In the TV version, this conversation begins with a tight close-up on Carl's face before the camera pulls back to show him sitting in the front seat of his car with the dog in the middle and Lorna in the passenger seat. This time, Carl announces that he almost took too much poison, and Lorna hears him and understands what he means. Having introduced her in the show's first scene and reminded viewers of her midway through, her participation in the last scene puts a different cast on some of the events of the story and introduces a level of complicity to her character. In retrospect, one may assume that the dog responded to Carl because it already knew him from time he had spent with Lorna. In adapting MacDonald's story for the small screen, Victor Wolfson made improvements, compressing the time of certain events and creating a parallel structure that makes for a more satisfying twist ending. I also prefer the name Cassandra with its connotations of prophecy over the name GB with its connotations of I'm not entirely sure what, and that the episode changes the dog's sex from male to female. It's worth pointing out that GB sits erect next to Carl at the end of the story. Take that however you wish. While Cassandra sits between Carl and Lorna, just as she got in between Carl and Annette. It's these details, not the twist, that make this episode work for me. Now, we've seen a number of rotten characters already in the series, some of whom get away with it. But Carl Borden seems to be particularly reprehensible. If there's anyone deserving of Hitch's retribution, as silly as it is, it's Carl.
You are all wondering, no doubt, how Carl Borden ended up in the jug. It is quite simple. His dog, Cassandra, was really a detective in disguise and turned him into the next town. It's getting so a man can't even trust his best friend.
Not much in the way of outside clips this time, which we will more than make up for next time. Alfred Hitchcock Presents Season 2 and Kiss Me Deadly are available at the Ann Arbor District Library. The clip from Macbeth, the Steve Canyon episode, and the Hitchcock Truffaut segment are available online. But I should also add that Downhill appears as a bonus disc in the Criterion Collection DVD of The Lodger, which is also available at the Ann Arbor District Library. If you wish to contact me about this podcast, please email me at sjoerdsmaa@aadl.org. That's sjoerdsmaa@aadl.org. And please put Hitchcock somewhere in the subject line. Next time, episode 60, number 22, starring Russell Collins and Rip Torn.
This concludes this session of our little court of inhuman relations. I hope you will rejoin us when we next present a different case. Good night.